Football Folk is doing. Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson. It's Super Bowl week, so we'll get into the Super Bowl and then, of course, some free agency talk. Sam, you ready to go?
I am. Is the studio ready to go?
No, not at all.
Have we weather problems? Is that what the issue is?
They deleted our faces and they put up curtains.
Huh. Okay. I mean, it's, yeah, fair enough.
You think they put up curtains because of weather? Like it's going to rain into the...
Well, weather can like knock out, you know, a window. Branch through the window. I don't know what happened.
I have a story about that.
Oh, of course you do.
But first, don't forget, all first-time depositors at Monkey Knife Fight to put at least $20 into their account while using the promo code PFF will receive a free PFF Edge annual subscription, $40 of value for just $20, and you get the opportunity to turn that $20 into even more money playing daily fantasy and prop games at the fastest-growing fantasy sports site in the U.S. It's Monkey Knife Fight. Go to Monkey Knife Fight, deposit your $20, use the promo code PFF, and receive your free PFF Edge annual subscription. This is only valid, I think, through this weekend, Sam. So it's your last chance to go and turn that $20 into far more value, especially getting that PFF Edge annual subscription. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We had played winter ball in Puerto Rico.
Winter ball?
Winter baseball. Puerto Rican League.
Okay.
So I played in the Puerto Rican League.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in a little villa with my roommate. And whoever, you know, they bunch of guys came in to change our windows one day.
To change the windows?
They were changing the windows out. They took all our windows out. They left in the living room. Took the windows out. Left.
Is this like a regular thing? Or?
I don't know. We needed new windows, apparently. So for like 2 hours, we had no windows. And it absolutely poured during that time. So it poured. It rained into our living room.
Yeah.
And my roommate and I were using curtains a lot like those. Standing where the windows were. These were like floor-to-ceiling windows, standing, holding the curtains up, trying to stop the rain. It was just like, you ever have a Tuesday morning where it just starts raining into your living room?
No.
Well.
Because I usually have windows.
Well, that was our Tuesday morning.
Or at the very minimum, I don't have them removed until somebody's there with replacements ready to put them right back in.
That was our Tuesday morning. Look, but the people don't like stories, though, so we're going to get to the football stuff. So we have a Super Bowl preview. We're bringing in Brad Spielberger. He is our contract expert over here at PFF. We're going to talk free agency. We're going to talk about his salary contract projection, some of the work he's done using PFF data to project things going forward, who's going to make the most money in free agency. So we'll get into that, and we'll bring him on a little bit later. But let's get into Super Bowl 55. Chiefs-Bucks. Discuss. Let's go.
Okay.
Let's get into it.
That's structured, huh?
Yeah.
I see. Another game of the playoffs where we've seen it already earlier in the season. This feels like, is this an abnormal year for how many of those we've had? Every game seems to have been a rematch.
I looked it up. The two.
Wow. Well done.
The two championship games were rematches. The divisional round,
Saints,
I think.
Saints-Bucks.
Saints-Bucks was a rematch, but Chiefs-Browns wasn't, right. And Rams-Packers wasn't.
Right.
What was the other one?
Buffalo
Ravens also wasn't. Yeah, so but like the week before, the wild card round, I think, was a lot of rematches. Well. Yeah. It feels like there's been a lot of rematches. And it's an interesting dynamic, right?
Yeah,
like how much
you looked it up. Did you get anywhere with your looking up? Or
I didn't come up with a number. I know the last three games were. The three biggest games were all rematches.
You went deep with the research, I see. Okay.
You were so excited tonight.
I know. I thought you had like an answer for me.
I let you down. Yeah, the last three have been rematches. How's that?
Yeah. I already knew that, but okay.
So same stuff we talked about last week. How much does the last matchup actually matter?
And particularly because, again, like some of the other rematches, like the first time they met was such an extreme,
so extreme
version of what the, you know, what was going to happen. The first quarter, Tyreek Hill, 7 for 7 for 203 yards, like just absolutely torched this Tampa Bay defense. Obviously, they made some adjustments as the game went on and slowed that bleeding down. But it's a lot like the Green Bay-Tampa Bay rematch, where the first game was such an absurd, extreme version of that game. Can you, what do you do? Like, do you expect the same thing to happen? Is that, so if, is Tampa Bay's primary focus going into this game Tyreek Hill, on the basis that he put up 200 yards in the first quarter the last time they met, and therefore that's the first thing we have to take away before we do anything else? Or do they go, well, that was freaky. That's probably not happening twice. Let's construct a more rational game plan.
Human nature would say stop Tyreek, right? But our guy Timo, you know, he's a Bucs guy and all that stuff, follows them closely and was thinking maybe that is the best strategy still. So even though Tyreek goes off for 200, and are you going to – you really can't cover him one-on-one. Like, he's going to get behind the defense. If he's going to get by you. But making Mahomes make 30- and 40-yard throws over and over again, more than capable of doing that, but making him make those low-percentage throws. Because what happened with the game after that is interesting as well. Mahomes fumbles in the red zone, and that was a big part of what closed the gap in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Bucs just played a lot softer. And the game went from track meet, Chiefs are just dominating, Mahomes and Tyreek are unstoppable, and it started looking like the Chiefs' offense of the last couple weeks, actually, which was Browns and Bills playing a little bit softer, allowing the underneath stuff, and the Chiefs just matriculating up the field.
Wow.
In old-school Chiefs fashion, Sam. So I think that's the interesting component. Do the Bucs say, yeah, we got to stop Tyreek, but we already kind of figured out the answer. We did that in the second half of the game and slowed them down, and we went bend but don't break and then made some red zone stops. Or do they say, all right, Mahomes, do it again. You know, hit every one of those throws again. I think it's going to be, let's play it a little bit safer, keep things underneath.
It's another one of those games as well where the strategy, if there is one, again, Mahomes has reached this point of, like, what the hell is the game plan? Like, just in a vacuum, forget what you do well and what they do well. What are you supposed to do to stop Patrick Mahomes, right? That, I think, is an existential question that every team facing the Chiefs is looking at when they go into a game. Let's assume for a moment, given how ridiculously well he carves up the blitz, the answer is not to blitz, or the answer is very not to blitz, right? Whatever you do, don't blitz. Right now, Mahomes has a passer rating of 136 against the blitz.
Yikes.
Right, perfect passer rating is 158.3. He's at 136 against the blitz. Probably not what you want to do, therefore. And, you know, there was no better example, I think, than against the Ravens. Ravens blitz as much as anybody in the NFL, led the league in blitz rate this year, led it in 2019 as well. And they're good at it, right? They don't just blitz, but they're very good at A, the way they blitz to generate pressure, and B, covering it up on the back end. So one of the reasons most teams don't blitz a ton is because it leaves a hole somewhere in your coverage. And the Ravens are very good at A, so if you know where the hole is, the opposition probably knows where the hole is, and that's where the ball is going to get passed, right? You pass in behind the blitz, big play, it's a problem. The Ravens are very good at knowing that you know that and therefore putting a guy right there and sort of dropping somebody into that space and causing you to hold the ball a split second longer, go somewhere else, and that's when the blitz actually gets home. But when Kansas City played Baltimore, it was like the Chiefs knew the playbook. It was like they knew exactly where Baltimore were going to drop players and therefore where to target. It was like three steps of chess further on. And Tampa Bay is one of those teams that blitzes a lot. On the season, only Baltimore and Arizona have blitzed more than Tampa Bay. So their game plan typically is blitz. Send the house, send pressure, get after the quarterback. They didn't do it against Mahomes the last time they played. And given what we know, that's the right way of approaching it. They blitzed 18% against Mahomes versus 42% against the rest of the league. Do they come after him more this time?
So that's an interesting one. I think we need to get into that offensive line discussion with the Chiefs, because right, that will
also influence that.
That might exactly influence that decision. I want to go back really quick, though, because you said, how do you stop the Chiefs? And I think as far as stopping Mahomes through the years, the Patriots have done it, right? Mm-hmm. He's got a low 60s grade, passing grade, against the Patriots. But the dynamic here is you'll hear a lot of people say Patrick Mahomes has never had a bad game. And depending on which stats you look at,
right,
it's true. right? Because against the Patriots, he has a low 60s PFF grade, but his passer rating is still about 105. So statistically, he really hasn't had a bad game. But you take your chance. Like, if Mahomes doesn't play well and you force him to some turnover-worthy throws, like, that's your best bet. You want to be able to do that. But my point is, replicating the Patriots' strategy is really, really difficult for defenses. It's a lot easier for offenses to morph week to week and adjust to what the defense is doing. It's not easy for a defense that plays zone, say, or blitzes like crazy or whatever their thing is, to go say, well, let's dial up what the Patriots do, which is play cover one and get, which is man coverage across the board with two extra defenders. And what the Patriots do is take those two extra defenders and get creative with it. They might double Tyreek. They might double Kelsey. They might double both. They might just sit in the middle of the field, right? And it's the uniqueness of the extra defenders while playing pretty good man coverage, which the Patriots do well. So the challenge here, I don't think the Bucs can just like dust off a Patriots game plan and say, hey, that works against Mahomes.
No, but that's the big issue, is that most teams just don't have the horses to do the first part of that, right? Which is play pretty good man coverage across the board before you start figuring out where you're putting the sort of the free hole defenders. Like, that's the benefit of that defense, is that you get those two guys to start playing with, which is what you need when you're trying to deal with Kelsey and Tyreek Hill. You effectively need two free defenders to be able to move around the defense and essentially take those two guys away, bracket cover both of them. The problem is, in order to free up those two guys, you need to have confidence that everybody else can hold up in man coverage, at least initially, before you start getting creative. And most teams just don't have that and are not creative enough to manage it. So that, I think, is a definite problem. The idea that Mahomes has never had a bad game statistically, it's really fascinating, right? Because you can look at that and make the argument of, well, okay, if the Patriots held him to a PFF grade in the 60s, but his passer rating was 105, what's the point, right? Like, he's therefore still productive, therefore it's not actually having any effect, therefore why is that good? But I think fundamentally, if you are forcing it, one, illustrates just how freaking hard to stop the Chiefs are, because even if you do limit their best player, they're so good everywhere else. All of the other things we've talked about in terms of Andy Reid and the weapons and the creativity and the screen game and the RPOs, there's so much free yardage and production there that even if you slow down Mahomes, everybody else can pick up the slack and they beat you anyway. But I do think there's value in this idea of, it's the Bill Belichick thinking of, if you can at least force a team to plan B, it's probably a good thing inherently, just in and of itself. Even if they might be good enough to beat you anyway, but at least you haven't let them beat you doing the thing they're most comfortable doing. You've at least forced them into an area of discomfort, which has made their life more difficult. Now, again, that doesn't mean you're going to win. They might just be better than you, but at least you can you've made them earn it, which I think is something.
It's not a Patriots show or a Patriots game, but the point is, to answer your question as well, though, why does it matter? It matters because Mahomes has 10 turnover-worthy plays in four games against New England through the years, and only three interceptions. So the part of the production that he's had against New England has actually been luck. The other part is, like, again, when they played New England earlier this year, he had two tap pass touchdowns that essentially he had the worst game of his season was against New England, and he had two tap passes for touchdowns that put his rating over 100 and made the stats look good. So that's why statistically the Chiefs offense doesn't really slump or have bad games.
Yeah, and it's not that they just made his stats look good. It is production that the offense was having. It just didn't really involve Mahomes, which is, I think, the point, is that you can slow Mahomes down and still have everybody else in that offense pick up the slack because it's so good. But the point you made, I think, about the turnovers is a good one, right? One of the reasons his grade was low is because he put the ball in harm's way. Maybe he got away with it a couple of times against the Patriots, but over long periods of time, he won't, or at least some of the luck will swing back in your direction. So again, it's playing the percentages. It's the better way of doing it, because even if you can ride that luck for a while, sooner or later, you're going to catch a break and get a turnover.
So that brings me to my next point. I still want to get to the Chiefs offensive line in a minute, but Chris Collinsworth podcast this week, he had John Gruden on, which I thought was great. Really great interview. Go check it out. Because Gruden talks about some real stuff and maybe, Live Air recruits Richard Sherman, who's a pending free agent. So it's a great interview, but Gruden's played both teams this year with the Raiders. Played the Bucs, played the Chiefs. And he made the comments that a lot of analysts make, which is, well, the Bucs got to sit on the ball. They got to keep Mahomes off the field. But the argument against that is always whether Mahomes plays great, good, or below average to the point we made it with the Patriots, the Chiefs still score points.
Yeah.
And the it's not like you could just have, well, we'll keep Mahomes to six possessions. He's going to get 10 possessions or whatever, you know, the average is. So you might salvage a possession. One, maybe, if you're lucky. So the Bucs need to play, score 38 points. How do we score 38 points? And if we land at 31, we might have a shot here. That needs to be the strategy for the Bucs. And my concern from their point of view is they have played the opposite over the last 2 weeks. Even though they got to 30, they got to 31, the last 2 weeks has been crazy early down running over and over and over again. They need to be aggressive. And it's got to be a Brady and playmakers game, not a Leonard Fournette game.
Ooh, playoff Lenny.
Playoff Lenny, yeah. Playoff Lenny. I know, he had one great run against the Packers. It was awesome. Mm. It was a great run.
Yeah.
Equaled 6 points. Mm. It's got to be a passing attack for the Bucs. Has to be.
One of the things I was thinking about as well about this game is, you know, for all the previewing and analysis and sort of scheme conceptualizing before a game of how things are going to go, you get into a game, somebody scores like 2 early touchdowns and the game plan goes out the window and game flow takes over from that point on, right? It completely alters the path of the way the game was going to go. When I look at this game, I think that basically every way that can happen hurts the Bucs. So, you know, whatever you think about
it. Either they get a lead or they don't.
Yeah, but either way, it's bad for them. It's just, I think, unique against the Chiefs. So let's say Tampa Bay gets down in a hurry. They already know that the Chiefs are going to put up a ton of points. If they get down by double digits, I know, look, one of the benefits of playing with Tom Brady is this man has like unbreakable mental strength, right? And he's never done. He always thinks he can come back. But not everybody else there does. You know, there's a bunch of Bucs players that, for them, this has already been their Super Bowl. Like, guys crying after the NFC Championship game. They've never been anywhere near this. Like, Mike Evans didn't know there was a ceremony after the NFC Championship game. It had never occurred to him, right? He's never been there. So, like, if he's playing with a bunch of guys for whom this is their first shot at this, and they don't have the experience of this game the way he does. So, if they get down in, like, a double-digit hole against the Chiefs in the Super Bowl, there's a lot of Bucs, I think, that will be looking at that and thinking, I don't know if we're coming back from this.
Now,
on the other hand, if the Chiefs get down by double-digit points, it's like their happiest place. It's like, oh, great, now we can, like, throw out the, you know, the conventional normalities of offense, like run the ball every now and again. Now we can just air it out with Mahomes, throw deep to Tyreek Hill every single play. This is our happy place right now. Like, if the Bucs get up to a double-digit lead, it's almost the worst place the Chiefs, or they can put the Chiefs. And if they get down by a double-digit point score, I think they're in real trouble.
So that's what happened in the first game. They got down 27-10, the Bucs. They did make a comeback, right? Brought it to 27-24. But here, again, is where the Chiefs are just incredible on offense. Calling the Chiefs incredible on offense, that's a broad thing. But your point is they're good with the lead. They're good when they're behind. They went 4 minute. The 4 minute offense is designed to run out the clock, right? You have a lead, you run out the clock. In the first game, the Chiefs got the ball with 4 minutes and 10 seconds left in a 3-point lead. And Brady, who is heating up, ready to make, you know, his classic fourth quarter comeback, didn't see the ball again. With 4 minutes and 10 seconds left, the Chiefs had Mahomes pick up a first down with a scramble, with two scrambles, and they ran a couple times, and then they, you know, of course, on 3rd and 7, connected with Tyreek Hill, their third down guy, 8 yards on 3rd and 7. That's all they needed. That's what they got. That sealed the deal, and the Bucs never see the ball again. So your point is essentially the Chiefs can, their offense is just good, whether they're down or whether they're running the clock out, they're really good. And,
yeah.
So the Bucs have to play an outstanding game. And I think, let's go to the offensive line stuff now. So Eric Fisher's hurt. He's out for the game. Mike Remmers moves from right tackle to left tackle. On paper, it doesn't look great. Mike Remmers, Nick Allegretti, Austin Ryder, Stefan Wisniewski, Andrew Wiley, a guard moving out to right tackle. The tackle position is going to be the biggest question because Allegretti and Ryder and Wisniewski, they're okay on the interior. They're fine. Remmers moving from the right side to the left side and Wiley on the right side. When you have Shaq Barrett, JPP, and the interior is an issue with Vita Vea, right? And Sue. The Bucks have a shot here. And the point I made on the Monday podcast is I think this is going to determine how the Chiefs build their team a lot going forward if the offensive line is seriously an issue. And they're going to be like, man, we've got to really protect Mahomes and have depth going forward.
Yeah. So on paper, this is the biggest mismatch in Tampa Bay's favor in the game, obviously. They've got a really good defensive line, a defensive front that can generate pressure. Vita Vea with another week under his belt could potentially be even better this week. They have the potential to wreck that Kansas City offensive line. On the other hand, the Chiefs offensive line on paper has looked like ass for a while. Like, okay, all you've done is lost one more guy. Now, okay, eventually you probably do reach a tipping point.
In theory, it weakens two spots because you move Remmers at least to a new position. He's used to playing right tackle. In theory, that's a tough challenge. Yes. Offensive linemen tell me that's a tough challenge.
But how much did you weaken it? It's, you know what I mean? Like, Eric Fisher's been solid, but I mean, you know, my point is that it's not like the line was great and then suddenly heading into this week, it's going to be a disaster. The line was already bad and you've made it a little bit worse. How big a problem is that really? And for the Chiefs in particular, all the stuff we talk about, you know, Mahomes, the argument is Mahomes is fantastic, but he has Kelce and Tyreek Hill and Andy Reid, and they are one of the most RPO-heavy offenses in the NFL. They have a ton of creative screens. They do a bunch of stuff that makes his life easier. And that's why that when Mahomes does have a bad game, they still put up a passer rating of over 100. And that because even though Mahomes is sort of fantastic, he's putting up otherworldly numbers because he has all these other things helping him as well. And that's why put together, all of that makes the Chiefs unstoppable. Those things all help offensive line as well. So the RPO game means that there's a bunch of plays where offensive linemen are not pass blocking. They're literally run blocking. They're not, like, that's what the RPO is. The offensive line is run blocking on the play. They're literally not part of the protection. So there's a whole bunch of those plays. The screen, same thing. They're not pass blocking. There's a whole bunch of plays where their ineptitude trying to contain pass blockers is just, or pass rushers is not a factor. So all of these things that are designed to help the offense and Mahomes just have a byproduct already of helping out the offensive line. So these are all reasons that I just don't see it being, I don't see it being like a critical factor in the game. I think it's Tampa Bay's best shot if they can like make that a big problem for Kansas City. But the Chiefs are like, they're still top half in the NFL in terms of pressure rate this year. They don't, even with the bad offensive line, it's not the catastrophe it would be for the Bucs. Like, if the Bucs were rolling out a team full of backup offensive linemen, forget it. Like, game over. Don't even show up. For the Chiefs, it's not great, but I don't think it's the reason they're going to lose.
I want to add some perspective here why it might not matter. So in the Green Bay game, you had backup offensive tackle, and the Bucs, well, they sacked Rodgers 5 times. And who does Patrick Mahomes get compared to the most? It's Aaron Rodgers, right? And with good reason, right? In pocket stuff, outside the pocket stuff, arm talent, all of it's great. But the one difference in Mahomes and Rodgers so far is Mahomes doesn't get sacked. And whether that is in part because, you know, a big chunk of the plays are unsackable, so to speak, screens and plays where you invite in the rush and RPOs and all that stuff, that definitely helps the old sack percentage. But just using sack percentage of total dropbacks, historically, Patrick Mahomes, 5th lowest sack percentage in NFL history. Mm-hmm. He's young. He's early in his career. He's just ahead of Drew Brees, who gets rid of the ball lightning quick. Brady's at 11th now. If you just, you know, Brady early in his career took a lot more sacks, you know, recently, but they're about the same type of guy. Mahomes and Brady at avoiding sacks, not getting sacked, which is essentially a QB type of stat. Rodgers, but just by comparison, is 84th in NFL history, almost two times as many, almost double the sack percentage as Mahomes.
And critically. Critically, Mahomes does that whilst holding onto the ball an age.
Exactly.
He's in the bottom 10 I mean, I've got 42 quarterbacks here, but he's like seventh in terms of the duration which he holds onto the ball. So it's a great point. All the RPO stuff, the screen stuff, all those things. Also those plays where Mahomes just like drops out of the pocket and keeps like backpedaling to right field inanely, and then suddenly fires the ball back, first down, Travis Kelce. Those are plays where, again, it doesn't matter how bad the offensive line are, because Mahomes is already saying, I don't care what you're doing. I'm like shuttling over here outside the pocket. You're like, where you were setting up the pass block is irrelevant to me on this play. I'm dropping to 15 yards and moving to my right. It doesn't matter if you're like face first in the turf and JPP is bearing down on me.
So this is why I think if people, I don't listen to a whole lot of Super Bowl analysis. I'm trying to keep a fresh mind here.
Keep yourself pure.
Yes.
Okay.
But if people are saying, hey, they just, you know, Rodgers had some backups out there and they just sacked him five times, they'll do the same for Mahomes. I don't think that's the point in the game.
I have heard that.
Okay. So I think the point in the game is when you have lesser offensive linemen, though, you compress the pocket. I've used this phrase a lot. You compress the pocket against Mahomes and you control the block more. And I think that's going to be the key for the Bucs. It's not so much taking Mahomes to the ground, because that's risky. If you don't get there, he breaks the pocket and you're in trouble. You compress it. Watch the escape lanes.
Yeah.
But your goal is to have him miss the open throws that are behind you,
the
right?
Guy,
by having a little bit of pressure in his face.
I think everyone will focus on JPP and Shaq Barrett against the tackles.
Right.
And that being the weakness. I think if the Bucs are going to turn this into a thing that actually affects the game, the guy that will do that is Vita Vea, because he can like basically smash that pocket from the inside.
And right.
Mahomes typically likes to escape out of the back of the pocket and around the edge anyway.
And you just keep your pad level on the edge.
Yes. So if all you have to do is to say JPP and Shaq Barrett, you're probably going to win your block anyway. Just make sure you win to the edge, because Vita Vea is coming up the middle. If Mahomes is going anywhere, he's coming past you. Make sure he doesn't get outside of you.
Right.
That, I think, is where they have a chance to really impact this, because Vea's 350 pounds worth of guy who can actually rush the passer. If he starts to squeeze Mahomes from the inside, you know, force him Aaron Donald style into those edge rushers who don't even have to win, they just have to be there, that can really impact the game. If they just expect, like, those guys are going to win around the edge, they're going to get after Mahomes, that will cause problems, I don't think that's going to happen.
So this comes back to that initial point that we made, right? If you're the Bucs, do you say, go ahead, hit Tyreek 40 yards down the field over and over again like you did in the first matchup? Because it's a longer developing play and your O-line does need to hold up a little bit better? Or does the Bucs game plan of keeping it safe actually play into the Chiefs' hands, because they're like, hey, we needed to protect our offensive line anyway. We are going to try to get the ball out a little bit quicker. We are going to try to run those zillion quick outs that are wide open. And that's what happened. Like, that was the Tyreek factor in the first game, right? You're so afraid of him over the top, a free 8 to 10 yards over and over and over again. And we've seen the Chiefs are more than willing to take that.
Yeah, I do wonder, though, to what extent usually it's true that, you know, the deeper downfield you're targeting, the longer it takes for the pass for the quarterback to actually fire the ball away. I do kind of wonder, though, how much that's actually true with Mahomes, because a lot of the time he's really good at doing that sort of Chad Pennington thing of put the ball in the air early, right?
You just compared Patrick Mahomes to Chad Pennington?
I did, yeah. And you know why? Because that's how comparisons work. I am fed up of people spasming at the
social
concept
team
of just invoking comparisons.
Tweet copy.
Here's the thing, right?
NFL podcast.
People have
Sam
forgotten,
Monson compares Patrick Mahomes to Chad Pennington.
People have forgotten the definition of the word to compare. Right? To compare does not mean to equate. When I say, I can compare you to the curtain, right? It doesn't mean I'm saying you are the curtain.
Just because we're wearing the same color?
Though you are wearing the same color. That's the beauty of this. I can say, Steve is a lot like that curtain because they're wearing the same shade of whatever the hell color that is. It doesn't mean I'm saying you are a curtain or the curtain is you. To compare is to find similarities and differences between the two things. So I can compare Mahomes to Chad Pennington and say, you know what's interesting between those two guys? They're both very good at putting a deep pass in the air early and letting a guy run under it. And therefore, it doesn't really matter how far you can throw it. because Mahomes can throw the ball like 90 yards and Chad Pennington can throw it like 34 in a good day, right? So those are the differences and similarities. That is to compare. The difference between that and to equate, which is to say Patrick Mahomes equals Chad Pennington, is stark and giant, and yet people seem to have lost that ability.
What I'm hearing is Patrick Mahomes is Chad Pennington per PFF Sam. It's just what I'm hearing. Hear whatever you want.
Anyway, my point is,
it's a good point.
The deep pass isn't necessarily going to be a long developing pass. It can be one where he's putting the ball in the air early, which he will do if Tyreek Hill is streaking past people 5 yards.
Let's wrap up this side of the ball. Chiefs offense, Bucks defense. How do you see it playing out? What do you think the Bucks strategy is, and how do the Chiefs handle that?
I mean, I think their strategy will be effectively similar in terms of they're not going to blitz him. Like, they are going to go away from their typical game plan.
So they're not going to be in tight, because the thing about the blitz is not just getting a free rusher. It's also that you know your rushers are getting one-on-ones. You know that JPP's one-on-one. You know that Shaq Barrett's 101. How tempted are the Bucks to say, man, one-on-one with Remmers and Wiley on the edge and a potential for one of our speedy linebackers maybe to get a shot on Mahomes?
Yeah.
They're tempted, no?
The problem is you also put everyone essentially one-on-one in the back end as well, and given what happened to them the last time, I don't think they're going to be willing to embrace that as a strategy. I think they're going to want to – also, the teams that have done, you know – I think the teams that have had the right strategy against Mahomes have been the ones that have backed off and dared him to win with patience and short, efficient passing. Again, it's not to say that you're going to win doing that, but it probably is your best shot. You know, the Bills strategy. The Bills have had two very good game plans against Mahomes and come off second best both times. It didn't mean that the game plans weren't good or that they were sort of successful in terms of Mahomes still got it done. But if that is that versus giving up 200 yards to Tyreek Hill in the first quarter, you're better off doing the first one, right? So I think Tampa Bay should have discovered, or should have, the learning from what they've seen this season is that if you're going to beat Mahomes, you're going to do it by backing off, making him be patient and efficient and executing well and just hoping for the best at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chiefs are going to score points.
Yeah.
Obviously. This is not breaking news. I think they'll get to 30, right? At least 30, maybe 27. I mean, and if you're the Bucs, you're happy and you just say, okay, we got to get more than 27.
You haven't mentioned the weather, though. Thunderstorms.
Yeah, let's get an update on that. Can we get a weather update? I looked earlier in the week and it looked clear. Mm. So it's now gotten to potential
thunderstorms.
Rain.
Huh? Yeah, rain, thunderstorms.
Come on, you can't have thunderstorms in a Super Bowl.
If everyone has to like bail to the locker rooms for an hour while the lightning passes, that's going to put a damper on the whole affair.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. Let's check Tampa. This is good. Good podcasting here.
Good radio.
See what my update is.
What do you
got? Sunday, 72 degrees, 60% chance of rain.
That's a reasonable
thunderstorms percentage. In the morning, then skies turning partly cloudy late. That was Pete Schrager. I saw Schrager. That's where you saw it, right?
Was
Schrager or was
no,
it?
No, somewhere else. Schefter might. It's what you did.
Yeah, well, come on, Adam. Sunday night, 32%
chance. These things change, you know? I mean, what was thunderstorms in the afternoon a few days ago might be thunderstorms in the morning now.
Yeah, 32%. Chance of rain is 30% Sunday night. Now, what's considered night? Is that 5 p.m.? Is that 8 p.m.? I don't know. Weather.com. Yeah, I don't know. If the rain could be a little bit of a factor for the pass game, potentially. So,
I mean, that might be the Bucks' best shot, right? It's that rain comes down and slows down the Chiefs themselves.
Yeah, potentially.
Good
luck trying to cover Tyreek when you don't have a footing.
It's also potentially good for Kansas City in terms of nothing really slow. Nothing's going to slow down a pass rush more than soggy underfooting.
True. Speaking of pass rush, let's go to the other side. Bucks offense, Chiefs defense. There's some high-level stuff that's big here. Brady versus Spags. Huge stuff there. But Chris Jones versus Aaron Stinney.
Yes.
The most experienced offensive lineman for the Bucs, the worst offensive lineman for the Bucs, you know, losing, you know, having a backup guard there with Chris Jones, and Chris Jones doesn't line up exclusively over right guard. He
should in this game.
He'll switch sides, but in this game, he probably should. The problem with doing that, though, is the Bucs will use a lot of two tight end sets where there is a run threat, and when there's a run threat, it's not as simple as Jones just you want to play the defense that you call. Chris Jones is going to play three technique for the most part, which is why he's going to line up over the guard. So it's not as simple as just put him over right guard the whole time. But I wouldn't be surprised if coming out of this game, it's another like, wow, Chris Jones just had 8 to 10 pressures and, you know, was the best defensive player on the field.
Yeah. I mean, Stinney has now started 2 games. He has a pass blocking grade of 48 in the first one and 27 in the second one. So, and if anything, the competition is going to be worse, harder in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So you should probably expect Aaron Stinney to get his ass kicked in this game. And when that has happened for Tampa Bay this season, when they have one offensive lineman that has been a turnstile, that has caused them problems. It's usually been the other side with Ali Marpet down. But usually it's not, you know, we talk all the time about the things that move the needle the most in terms of winning games. It's quarterback, it's wide receiver, it's corner. This has the potential to be a one-on-one trench matchup battle that actually changes the outcome of a game.
Yeah, it's also extreme.
Yes.
Extreme matchups.
Right. The offensive line is usually not about how good players are. It's about how bad the weakest link is. Because if your weakest link is tissue paper thin, it can lose every single snap and ruin every single passing play you have called.
Well, look at Von Miller in the Super Bowl against the Panthers. It was Mike Remmers that he dominated. But it's like, if you just can't block somebody up front, that's a massive issue.
Particularly inside when you have an immobile statue of Tom Brady behind you.
Oh, the hate.
Well, it's not hate.
It's a nimble 43.
Reality.
He's pliable, at least.
I'm sure he's stretchy, but he might need to be because he's about to get jumped on by Chris Jones a bunch of times.
So the big matchup, though, of course, is Spags against Brady. Spags was the defensive coordinator. 2007, the undefeated Patriots against the Giants.
Yeah.
They held one of the best offenses of all time, maybe the best of all time, down to 14, only 14 points in that game. In the first matchup here, the first matchup was like a microcosm of everything we've discussed about the Bucs this year, which was when they're blitzed. Do they have answers? Are they on the same page? Brady threw an interception in this game, trying to throw a hot route to Mike Evans. Mike Evans might not have been in the right. It didn't really matter. The throw was off, hit a defensive player. Was Evans in the right spot? You know, do they have answers to the blitz? And I went back and rewatched all that. The pre-snap motion that Spagnuolo is using every single snap over and over and over again. It looks like single high. Now it's too high. It looks like all out blitz and it's single. I mean, it's just rotating and just. And it just puts enough indecision into the quarterback, even a veteran 43-year-old like Brady, enough indecision for him and his receivers to be on the same page that I think it's just really tough to be efficient and complete pass after pass after pass like I think the Bucs are going to need to do to win this game.
Yeah, and Spagnuolo, the big difference between him and what went before him was this ability to game plan on a specific game-by-game basis, and that's what most of the best coaches in the NFL are able to do. It's what Belichick did so well for years. You know, gloss came off that a little bit with no Brady, apparently. But the point is, when you get to the playoffs, that's when you need that because you're going to come up against the best teams in the NFL. And what you do normally might not work. So Tampa Bay is a good example of that. They like to blitz a ton. Against the Chiefs, that probably isn't the right way of going. So your ability to game plan something else is going to be big in determining who wins the game. The Chiefs, Spagnuolo's defenses have taken a step up in the postseason. Like they're allowing almost half a yard less per play in the postseason than they are during the regular season, when in theory they're going up against better competition. So he's done an incredible job, not just with those, I mean, dating back to those Giants teams of dialing something up for the playoffs that the offenses have just struggled with.
The Chiefs, we've used this stat the last few weeks as well. Lowest passer rating on passes thrown beyond the line of scrimmage, beyond the first down marker. And Tom Brady, the guy that some people like to criticize for being a dink and dunk quarterback, has thrown the ball beyond the line of scrimmage at a higher percentage than anyone else. He has fully taken to the Bruce Arians system in that regard, right? So something's got to give there. It's not necessarily strength against strength, but it's the Chiefs' strength against what the Bucs like to do. And they're pretty good at it, right? Brady's had an excellent season, number 2 graded quarterback this year. Something has to give there. And I think in the first matchup, a lot of what you saw was inconsistent offense from the Bucs in the first half. But then there was a couple big plays. So as much as Spags, I think snap for snap, challenges the offense. What the Chiefs defense needs to avoid is, in the first matchup, you had a pass to the flat for Ronald Jones where he just runs by everybody for like a 38-yard touchdown. Late in the game, you have Mike Evans run a little double move, and he's wide open up the seam. Like, there were a couple easy throws in there. Gronk ran through the defense for a big 40-plus yarder. So snap for snap, the Chiefs, I'd say, got the better of the Bucs. And Brady also had one incredible throw to Chris Godwin on a post where he was getting smacked in the mouth. Like, so there's three, four, five big plays that the Bucs created there that were either a coverage bust or just general bad defense by Kansas City. But much like we saw, say, in the Green Bay, that was the Green Bay game 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? I mean, the Bucs had a few big plays, but like snap for snap, it was like, ah, you're getting 2 yards here and negative two there and incompletion there. So I think the Bucs need to play a more efficient game, and the Chiefs are looking to at least avoid the big plays.
Yeah, and we say this pretty much every week, but this Tom Brady, Bruce Arians offense, it's skewed more Arians than it has Brady in terms of the where they were coming from last year's. And the reason it's been so successful is that Brady has been singularly amazing at executing that in year one. Has, I think, the highest average depth of target, or the second highest average depth of target in the NFL this year, whereas everybody else creates 40 turnover-worthy plays over the season when they do that. Brady's at, like, was he 12 for the regular season, plus however many more he's had in the postseason, which
the
is less.
People heard that on the show last time.
Which is less than the number of interceptions he's had. Yeah. But the point is...
Good stat.
Yeah, the point is, when this offense is great when the quarterback avoids mistakes. And when they don't avoid mistakes, obviously it's catastrophic because they're usually turnovers. Brady has to have a clean game. I know it's a cliche pretty much every time the quarterback needs to have a clean game, otherwise they're going to have problems. But like, Brady just can't put the ball in harm's way. And if he does, they probably don't have a shot of winning this. And I know...
But to our earlier point, though, Mahomes doesn't need to play a clean game.
No.
Like, Mahomes didn't
play
a
does.
Clean... Mahomes had four turnover-worthy plays in the Super Bowl last year and two actual interceptions. Right? And they still scored, what, 31 points against one of the best defenses in the NFL.
Yeah.
Mahomes doesn't need to play a clean game for them to score. Brady does need to play not only a clean game, but a game with 4 to 6 big-time throws down the field.
But also avoid, and you know, it would help if he got lucky as well. Like, people are saying the guy was bad in the second half last week, or not last week, 2 weeks ago, because he had three interceptions. They weren't catastrophic. You know, he had one turnover-worthy play, I think, in the game. Like, he was getting a little bit unlucky in terms of what was happening to that football. So he needs to, A, have a clean game in terms of not putting the ball in harm's way, and B, like, avoid some bad turnover luck as well.
For sure.
Either one of those things. The point being, the Bucs probably can't win this game if Brady turns the ball over.
Chiefs defense. So let's talk playmakers now, because, again, the Bucs rolling Mike Evans and Chris Godwin out there. Antonio Brown banged up. We'll see if he ends up playing. And I don't know if it's better or worse. I would say if Antonio Brown's on the field, it's definitely better for the Bucs. But again, as long as they don't forget about Scotty Miller.
Yeah.
I mean, that Scotty Miller is worth a 40-yarder per game.
Fastest player in the NFL,
He thinks he's faster than Tyreek?
He does.
Oh, man, I don't know about that.
I mean, no.
Yeah, he's definitely not.
But yeah.
All I'm saying is Scotty Miller will give you an opportunity for an explosive play. And he has 9 on the season. So it's not like he literally has one every single week. But it's because once Antonio Brown showed up, he wasn't getting nearly as many snaps. Scotty Miller gives you a chance to flip the field, man, to get behind the defense. So I think the Bucs' best strategy is, you know, have Antonio Brown there, and you get your top three, get some Scotty Miller snaps in there, take those shots, and try to get the ball down the field. But the more you hand off to Leonard Fournette or Ronald Jones, the less Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, Antonio Brown, Scotty Miller, Cameron Brait, and Rob Gronkowski have a chance to make big plays.
True. If you were, you know, if you were a speedy wide receiver, how fast would your, like, official 40 time need to be before you'd even float the concept of being faster than Tyreek Hill?
I'd have to have a recorded 4.19.
4.19?
Yeah.
I think if you get...
Or like John Ross could probably lay claim. Like, hey, I ran a 4.22. Well, you ran a 4.29, I mean, or whatever, Tyreek.
Because of the nature of these things, right? Racing in pads, for whatever. If I had a 4.3 flat on my resume, you know, like a laser time 4.3 flat, I'd think about it. You know, Scotty Miller has a 4.39. It's a full... Nah, like, yeah. No. Look, come on.
Tyreek ran like an official 4.27, 8, whatever it is.
He's in the 4.2s. and he might be faster than that.
Yeah, plays faster on the field.
Right, you ran like a 4.4 flat. Stop it. That's like, it's not slow, but that's, there's like a bunch of big, relatively pedestrian guys that run a 4.4 flat. Forget it.
I think I had a 4.9 in me at one point.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Anyway.
Well, you should, I mean, you know, it's only like 7 steps for you.
It's true. It's all about
how
steps.
How long can it take?
It's all about the steps. It's funny because the Chiefs' cornerbacks, if you just said coming into the season, we got Tre'Davious Ward, Bashaud Breeland, and rookie Lejarius Sneed at corner, you're like, oh my gosh, like what? The Chiefs are we're saying this. Like, yeah. The Chiefs are rolling in with this group. As much as I love Lejarius Sneed, one of my favorite mid-round sleepers in the draft, wasn't expecting him to be the highest-graded rookie corner this year, which he was. But that has turned into a pretty good group, and it's not just a pretty good group. Like, Ward is good. Tre'Davious is good against bigger receivers. Bashaud Breeland's good on the outside. Again, like playing man coverage, he's having his best season in a while, and Sneed's really taken to the nickel spot. So it is actually really good matchups here. Yep. I think the Chiefs, again, are weaker at linebacker than Daniel Sorensen in the middle of the field where the tight ends can do some damage. The problem there is Tyrann Mathieu is always lurking. And again, I think that's what makes the Chiefs defense difficult to complete passes against.
And they've been changing how they use some of these guys as well. Like Lejarius Sneed has suddenly become a threat on the blitz. He didn't have more than one blitz up until week 13, had two in week 13, and then 15, 16, and then the two playoff games, he's had 4, 4, 5, and 7. Like, they've been ramping up how much they send him on the blitz, which can only make things more problematic for opposing offenses. Like, he's had a sack in 4 straight games.
That's crazy.
As a cornerback.
And that's what I'm saying about Spags' defense, man. They're coming from all angles. It's got to be Brady and the receivers need to be on the same page. And that's where it tends to be. Like, does that make it a Gronk game? Like, does he have the most confidence that Gronk's going to be? That's like beating the blitz is the quarterback and the receiver being on the same page and just the receiver knowing where to be and the trust factor, right? And being open. Does that make it a Gronk game again? He had a big game against the Chiefs the first time around.
Mm. And so it could be. This is the Gronk versus Kelce game. Somehow both the same age, despite like
Gronk they're the same age.
There's like 3 months between them, but they came into the league like 3 years apart.
Yeah,
Gronk had like 45 touchdowns before Travis Kelce had
Gronk
taken an NFL snap.
Real young,
yeah.
When he came in, yeah.
And Kelce was like 25 when he came into the league. Like,
well, Kelce's the guy now. Kelce's
right, but so Kelce's consequently, better. Kelce is like in his prime, whereas Gronk has already declined, retired, and come back. At the point where, and they're the same age. It breaks my brain that those two are effectively peers.
Man, there's really a million different things to discuss here. The Bucs' two safeties, Antoine Winfield, Jordan Whitehead, might be banged up and hurt. JPP didn't practice on Wednesday. So there's still a lot of storylines in this game. But bottom line, we're going to wrap it up. Do you want to talk legacy stuff at all? Do you buy into the Mahomes, Brady?
Well,
legacy stuff and what's this going to do for...
It's pretty simple, right?
It going to do for sports talk radio for the next 15 years?
Brady wins. Brady ascends to the Michael Jordan plane of there will never be a bad word said about him until 25 years later when there's a new guy and we're like, oh, he wasn't really that good in the first place if you actually look at his numbers.
Jordan was overrated.
Right. It's like, hey, if you actually look at these scenarios where Jordan really choked, it's bad. And then everyone will mock that guy for going against like the conventional mythology that's arisen around this guy. So that's where Brady goes with another ring. Also, you know, poor old Bill Belichick sitting at home just getting more and more bitter about the whole thing. Anyway, Mahomes, it's the chance to, A, like prevent the GOAT taking further steps ahead of where you need to get to, right? If you're Patrick Mahomes, your eventual goal in all this is to be better than Brady by the end of your careers. If Brady gets another ring, that just set you back, particularly if it's one that you could have gotten by winning against him. I don't think it really affects anything from Mahomes other than Brady taking a step ahead of him in terms of where he needs to be. But like his legacy is, he's still got plenty of time. He'll still have a ring and have been to 2 Super Bowls at the age of 25 and 3 straight AFC Championship games. Mahomes is still going to be seen as the best player in the NFL. Regardless of what happens in this game, the only thing that happens that can affect him is that instead of being 6-2, he goes 7-1 down in Super Bowl rings, which just makes the legacy chasing harder.
I think Brady just has so much to gain And I don't think he's got much to lose.
But it's all house money, right? Yeah.
It's all house money. There are people that still think, well, Montana didn't lose a Super Bowl. It's like, well, Brady went to six more Super Bowls than him. That means he didn't lose in the championship game or the divisional round.
I did hear somebody unironically the day try and make the case that Montana was a better quarterback than Tom Brady.
Stop it.
It's like, look, I think there was a period during Brady's career where you could genuinely make the case that, look, he's ridden his luck a lot. And he was on some very good teams, and he wasn't that great. And you can kind of, you know, put down a lot of the winning stuff to things other than Brady, right? But since that point, he's had another Hall of Fame career.
Right.
It's time to drop that. Like, it's done. Whatever argument you may have had 8 years ago is no longer valid. And if you're still clinging to that, it's just time to come off the table.
Hold on. Here's some perspective. I tweeted this out the other day. I wasn't expecting it to take off like it did. But Peyton Manning's going into the Hall of Fame this weekend.
Yeah.
That's Brady's biggest rival.
Right.
Peyton Manning's going into the Hall of Fame, and Brady's playing in the Super Bowl.
And it's not like Peyton hung it up early. Like,
right.
Peyton was 39 or something when he retired.
And since Peyton's retired, Brady's been to four different Super Bowls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Brady's... Real quick, just to wrap it up, because we'll do our picks. Brady's last four Super Bowls in the fourth quarter in overtime. 93, so a little over a game's worth of action. 538 passing yards in essentially four quarters in a drive. 538 passing yards, four touchdowns, 93.2 PFF grade. So let's get to prediction time, because I see everybody at PFF is afraid to pick the Bucs. I decided to go the other way.
Oh, yeah?
I would pick the Chiefs normally.
Oh, I see.
You know, I go with the favorites.
You just want to have that, the Monday morning graphic that I had when Seattle knocked off
the
Denver.
One guy that went the right way. I'm taking the Bucs 31-27, and I'm hanging my hat on more Brady fourth quarter magic, and the Bucs just have to make a couple stops defensively. I think the pass rush actually does impact the game here. So I'm taking the Bucs 31-27. Where are you going?
I don't remember what my score was, but I'm picking the Chiefs.
35-27.
35-27?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm going. Interestingly, PFF Greenline, which you can get, which leverages all of PFF's data to essentially show you where there's an edge in the betting markets, Greenline likes the Bucks more than the spread. Like, we have it closer than obviously the spread has Kansas City favorites, 3-point favorites. Greenline likes the Bucks closer, and it's really, I think it is the defense, right? It's the number one versus number three overall team in PFF ELO, number two versus number five in offense, but number two for the Bucks on defense versus number 14 for Kansas City. Like, they think that Greenline thinks that there's a potential needle mover in that Bucks defense.
If you want access to Greenline, it's all part of PFF Elite, which, by the way, is 25% off through this game, through the Super Bowl, using the promo code SuperBowl25, SuperBowl25, 25% off any PFF subscription, whether it's Edge or Elite. The draft guide's out, 477 pages of awesome. It's being updated on Monday as well. So you get the draft guide, you can get Greenline, get all your picks as part of PFF Elite. And you get the draft guide with Edge, 25% off, SuperBowl25. All right, let us know your predictions. Hashtag let us know.
Hmm.
Let's get into some offseason talk.
You ever check that hashtag, or people just like endlessly tweeting us and we're not even paying attention?
Yeah, I should probably keep that on the dashboard or something.
Yeah.
Keep tabs on it.
Yeah.
PFF, let us know. Maybe it might need to make it more specific.
Maybe.
All right, let's figure out how to get, we'll get Brad in here. We'll talk some free agents and contracts and all sorts of good stuff, because there's 30 other teams in the NFL for us to discuss.
There are.
Hey guys, after the year we've all been through, saving money should be at the top of everyone's resolution list. So if you're still paying insane amounts of money every month for wireless, what are you doing? Switch to Mint Mobile. It's the easiest way to save this year. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you maximize your savings with plans starting at just $15 a month. Sam, I know you're all in on Mint Mobile. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, moved over to the U.S. and couldn't believe how insane the cell service was, how much it costs. And apparently it doesn't have to be that way. You go to Mint Mobile, you cut your wireless bills in, not just in half, cut it way down and save on all the wasted money that goes from having these bricks and mortar stores. Online only cuts the bill hugely, and the service works perfectly.
It's a no-brainer for people looking for extra savings this year. Mint Mobile offers premium wireless for just $15 a month. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Mint Mobile has you covered with their 7-day money-back guarantee. Switch to Mint Mobile, get premium wireless service, and it starts at just $15 a month. To get a new wireless plan for just that $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/PFF. That's mintmobile.com/PFF. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/PFF. All right, welcome into Brad Spielberger. What's your official title here at PFF? I'm just calling you Cap, Cap Expert here, man. How's that?
Salary Cap Analyst in the Research and Development Department.
Okay, there we go.
There you go.
It sounds very official. So welcome, Brad. He's one of the newest members at PFF. And yes, he understands numbers with dollar signs better than anybody else at PFF here. So we're going to get into some of the free agency as a whole. But let's start with like your background, how you ended up here, and we'll get into your contract projections and kind of that process and everything. But what's your background? Yeah. How'd you get here?
Yeah, sure. So actually, funny enough, it was just last week, but I went to Tulane Law School, which is known for their sports law program, and they have a competition every year. It's called the Tulane Pro Football Negotiation Competition, where basically you get mock negotiations. Let's say, all right, you're Amari Cooper, you're the Dallas Cowboys. You're going to come in, you know, you're the agent, you're the team, you're going to negotiate back and forth, you're going to use some stats, you're going to use some comparable players, stuff like that. And then, you know, at the end of it, you try to, you know, sign a deal. So we run that competition every year, and I was fortunate enough to meet Jason Fitzgerald from OverTheCap.com, who is now the, you know, the official provider of salary cap information and contract information for us at Pro Football Focus, and started working with him after my first year of law school. Just said, hey, I'll do anything you need, any, you know, grunt work or whatever it is. And kind of worked my way up from there. He gave me more and more responsibilities on the site. And then ultimately, him and I wrote a book together, actually, called The Drafting Stage, kind of creating a new draft pick value chart, because the Jimmy Johnson chart is just a list of numbers with nothing behind it. And then finally was fortunate enough to meet Eric Eager. He was one of the judges at the competition, which was kind of him to do. And, you know, just kind of created a relationship there and you know, from there, just worked through it and kind of presented that I thought the next step for PFF was, you know, you already dominate the space with, you know, video content and cutting clips for players. You already have the best stats and analytics and all that. That next step that kind of will push us over the edge is, you know, also being a big player in the contract space. And so that's how it all began.
Yeah, you and I are doing some work together on some of that behind the scenes for NFL teams. And, you know, again, the biggest thing when it comes to signing players, it's how good are they? How valuable are they? And then how much are they worth, right? So you've come up with some salary projections or contract projections. How do we go about that entire process? What goes into that process for you?
Yeah, so, you know, first you just analyze the market, you know, from a 30,000-foot view, just how many teams have a need for this position. Something I learned later also is you got to look in the draft, not the full draft, but maybe the top 50 or top 100, how many, you know, good players at each position are there going to be? Because sometimes teams will say, yeah, we could pay a guy, or we think this guy could be an impact player right away. And then from there, it's stats first. So you're going to break it down from comparable players looking at, you know, based on position. Let's say it's an edge rusher, looking at their pressures, their win percentage, their defensive stops, stuff like that. And then when you find comparable players, generally you want to look same age, same contractual situation. So are they a free agent? Are they, you know, they have 1 year left, so it's an extension or, you know, whatever. And then you start looking at their old contracts, of course. And then lastly, you adjust, which we'll, you know, we'll get into. You adjust for cap inflation, stuff like that. So, you know, the markets are going to grow. You know, the position markets are generally going to grow kind of, you know, in continuity with the salary cap. Obviously, this year, that'll be interesting to see how teams and agents handle that. But, yeah, so it's really just finding comparables and then just kind of working off of that.
Yeah, what do you talk to me about the landscape now? Because, obviously, the salary cap has typically gone up year after year after year after year as the NFL makes more and more money. But we're in this COVID world where, you know, revenues are down. There's, you know, a relative lack of fans in the stands. What's the salary cap going to do and how much is that going to impact everything?
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest misconceptions about the salary cap in a general sense is folks thinking that, you know, it's a 1 year window or that you have to fit under the, you know, the 1 year cap and that's what you're working with. And obviously you do have to be cap compliant, but it's really the full, you know, or 95% of current year. And then you can borrow money from, you know, 4 years down the line by pushing money down the line, stuff like that. So
we call that teams have, the Saints.
Go ahead.
I said we call that the Saints.
Yes, we call it the Saints and Eagles and void years and all sorts of tricks they, you know, they use to just house money in the future. And of course, the credit card bill always comes due. You know, as we know with our GameStop shares, but you know, for the in the short term, you know, you can just kind of, you know, roll along and like you said, the cap generally is going to go up about 6% a year, which has been about 10 million in recent years. And then of course, you know, unfortunately now that's not the case, but I think we saw with the Rams trade, you know, with the Goff Stafford trade that, you know, that's a signal that teams, yes, they're obviously going to have to make some maneuvers this offseason. But I think they're generally bullish. I think the 17th regular season game is going to obviously, you know, create an influx of revenue. I think gambling, you know, gambling money is going to be another influx of new revenue streams. So, like I said, they're going to look at, okay, we just need to push money into the future and then hope that the cap does spike as we expected.
Let me ask about the Saints specifically here, though, because according to Over the Cap, they are at the moment, and I don't know how real these numbers are, but it, like at the moment, $101 million over the cap, right, for 59 players, which looks like an absurd number. And they've been, you know, this is their credit card being due. Or is it? Is there even a world where the Saints can bring back players, re-sign players, sign a free agent or two, be competitive next year? Or are we looking at a completely new Saints team next year, given the situation that they've been put into?
So this is, you know, obviously I haven't been doing this forever, but this is the worst situation that I've seen. And I venture to guess it's probably the first time a team has ever been projected to be, you know, $100 million over the cap. This is the credit card bill becoming due. And the whole point the entire time was we have, you know, one of the five best quarterbacks to ever play the game in Drew Brees. Why not just continue to build around him and continue to, you know, kind of capitalize on this window we have? You know, they obviously didn't make a Super Bowl or win a Super Bowl, but they were winning, you know, 13 games a year. So they capitalized to some extent. But it's not as drastic as maybe it's presented. Like, they're not going to have to shed the whole roster and tank and go 2-14 next year just to get by. They're going to have to just continue, as they've already been doing, to push a ton of money into the future, you know, on some older players as well. But, you know, Drew coming off the books takes $25 million right away. So already you chop that, you know, in a quarter off of that. I think the one real effect we'll see is I'd be surprised if they can retain Marcus Williams or Trey Hendrickson. I just don't see how that happens. And then I know folks in New Orleans have said, like, now they're going to be in on Stafford. You know, we heard they didn't even call. And we saw the comments, you know, from Sean Payton yesterday about Jameis Winston. I think it's pretty clear their plan at quarterback is going to have to be another, you know, kind of cheaper deal for Winston, build around him or kind of, you know, use the roster around him. They can't really compete on big contracts.
That's the problem with drafting so many good players in the 2017 draft. Like, Marcus Williams and Trey Hendrickson are probably the fourth and fifth best players in that draft class, with Alvin Kamara, Ryan Ramczyk, and Marshawn Lattimore. Very difficult to just keep those guys, right? After you have one of the best draft classes probably of all time. Let's talk some of the contract projection stuff that you've worked on. You've used PFF WAR a little bit in that, right? As far as trying to use that as a proxy for what a player is or how the league values him. How much does that factor in to your projections, and how close are the projections compared to what you've seen historically?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So one of the first things I did when I got here, you know, and got access to that glorious WAR data was I really wanted to see, you know, how predictive is our wins above replacement, you know, WAR data as compared to the market. So with a couple adjustments for age, for draft position, you know, and then looking at, you know, a little bit of injury, stuff like that, once you adjust some very, you know, objective adjustments that are just kind of, we know, control the market to an extent, they're highly accurate. There was, I want to say, basically what I use it to predict is the average per year amount, which of course is not, you know, the end all be all, you know, guarantees and stuff like that obviously matter more to the player, but the way the market is gauged and the way they compare each other is by average per year. So that was kind of the you know, output variable that I wanted from the input of the WAR. I mean, we're projecting around 85%, just based on this, 85% of the projections were within 20% of that APY. So, you know, if it's a 10 million APY in reality, you know, we were right around there, 8 to 12 million, you know, with just that projection and nothing else. But then, of course, I'll go back in and say, all right, well, yes, this guy's WAR is this, but he missed, you know, 8 games in this season, so I got to tweak it there. Or another big one, it's referred to as a platform year, which is, you know, the contract year. Obviously, if a guy, you know, stunk 2 years before the contract but was incredible, you know, the 1 year before the deal, then you got to weight that and kind of take the trajectory into account. But it gives you a great baseline.
So this season in particular, it's a weird free agent group. It's pretty strong at the top. I think there's a lot of very good players, and then it gets weak very quickly. How do you anticipate the money getting shared out? Who's going to get the big money deals? Are the sort of middle class of free agents going to get squeezed out? How do you think the money's going to get divvied up?
So I completely agree with you, and I think it kind of works with what we discussed with the cap. So I agree, it's a little bit top heavy, and then there's some solid players, but not, you know, a lot of guys that jump off the page, especially, you know, those higher paid positions like edge rusher. There's not, you know, a ton of great edges coming on the market. I think the top guys will still get their money, and I do still think that they will be pushing, you know, the ceilings of their respective position markets, or, you know, still landing the top five or top 10, whatever. Even though, you know, as I mentioned, you generally, you know, adjust with inflation. I think they're going to ignore that for the top paid guys. I then do think that middle tier of kind of older guys, if you're around 30 and if you were, you know, looking for maybe a 3-year deal, kind of in the middle tier, you might just sign a 1-year flyer and try to cash in again the following offseason. So I would say we're going to see a lot of top heavy and you know, and minimums, kind of like the Rams approach to, you know, the roster construction, I suppose. But I think every team is going to kind of follow that MO of the top guys are going to get their money. They don't care. And then we might have to pinch some of those mid-tier vets.
Before I want to get into some Dak discussion in a second, but I want to ask you about the Rams too. And I think this might be a daily topic for us, Sam, is the Rams strategy essentially. And by the way, I broke into the 2-for-1 drafts podcast, broke in to ask this question in the middle of the episode, just upset the entire episode. They gave a good answer, Austin and Sam. So we have an answer on another PFF podcast. But the question is the Rams strategy and the rumors that they just don't value first round picks. It's not even a rumor. They're not going to have one from 2017 to 2023. So what are your thoughts on that? Player versus draft value? Are they making the right move in theory? Not even drafting in their head, mitigating risk by bringing in players that are more known commodities?
Well, you teed this up perfectly. I'm actually in the process of doing an article for it right now. It'll be out on pff.com probably next week. So keep an eye out for that, folks.
Nice.
I reject the idea. I don't think they even necessarily believe that. I think Les Snead was maybe getting a little bit of, you know, help from you know, some friends in the media there. Just that, again, it's not necessarily a bad idea. It's not necessarily like I see the argument that we'll take a sure thing over a potential good first round pick, and they of course think they're going to be picking, you know, 25th or later. But I mean, you just go look anecdotally at the history of some of these deals. Even again, off the top of the head, an easy one: the Jay Cutler trade was the exact same trade. It was 2 first round picks, a 3rd round pick, and Kyle Orton for, which, you know, that's a little bit mean to Jared Goff, but for Jay Cutler. So yeah, exact same trade. The Bears then gave him a gigantic extension, which maybe Stafford doesn't get, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised there. And then he was never a top half of the league quarterback. You know, again, per our wins above replacement, his best Bear season I think was 19th, you know, in WAR. So there's no such thing as a sure thing with players either. And then the component that no one talks about is the surplus value of that rookie contract. So even look at an example from this past year, Stephon Diggs leads the NFL in what, receptions and receiving yards, has an incredible season, and the Vikings still got a better or you know, equally good receiver on a deal that's worth $10 or $15 million less per year over the next 3 years. So, you know, again, it's anecdotal, of course. They could have taken, you know, Jalen Rager or somebody else, but
right.
But I reject the idea that it's a sound strategy over the long haul. It's eventually going to catch up to you, but I do recognize that if you have, you know, arguably the best defensive player of all time in Aaron Donald, you have Jalen Ramsey, one of the best corners, if not the best corner in the league. The entire offense is under contract. You know, all their weapons are already signed. Then yeah, you know, be aggressive, go for a window. Why would you try to, you know, carry Jared Goff and add, you know, 20th overall pick first rounders to try to get over the hump? Yeah, I get it there. But in general, no. And obviously we see these trades for, you know, edge rushers and safeties and stuff like that. And that's obviously, you know, not great business over the long haul.
How do you think that the Dak Prescott Dallas Cowboys thing is going to work its way out? And why has it got to the point it's gotten where, you know, there's still no deal done?
You know, I think part of Dallas's negotiating strategy is they like to, quote unquote, win the negotiation. And I think I understand wanting to, you know, exert control and be the big dog in the negotiating room and all that. But at a certain point, it benefits both parties to just take care of your guy, make sure he's happy, he's comfortable, he's not, you know, worried about getting hurt or anything like that. And he just has a deal that's requisite with his talent and his value. And it just works out for both parties. So I think a little bit of that comes in. you know, I really don't think they think that he's a true franchise quarterback, and they look at their roster and say, well, he's obviously been productive, but we've given him, you know, great offensive line play, great weapons, you know, all of these things. So, and then they also, of course, love to argue, well, look, you're going to be a broadcaster, you know, with Jim Nance in 5 years, or you're going to be, you know, Kellen Moore, you're going to be the, you know, the coach of a team. So they think there's other aspects of value that they can kind of leverage in a negotiation, which I think probably worked in the past. But I mean, look, we're in kind of a player empowerment era, and I don't think Dak is really falling for any of those tricks. So that being said, I do still think it works out. You know, the quarterback, they're not in position to draft a guy, really. They could try to, you know, trade up, I suppose. But they have this roster now that's, you know, quote-unquote win-now roster. And they saw how bad it got when they lost Dak. So I do think it's going to work out. I think he's going to settle in around Deshaun Watson's value. You know, the years is the biggest, you know, holding point there. He wants a shorter deal to cash in again. They want a longer deal. You know, who knows how that works out. But I do think eventually it works out. It's just a matter of, I think the Cowboys need to be, I don't know, I think they're the ones that need to move.
Yeah, that makes sense. How much do you think is them having that hard line in the sand? You mentioned that, you know, you don't think they 100% buy into the idea that he is this transcendent franchise quarterback. And I think there's pretty good evidence to support that, independent of them. He isn't and hasn't been at the level of Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers, even Deshaun Watson, from what we saw from Watson this year. So how much do you think they're actually right to say, look, you're not at this level. Like, we don't want to pay you Deshaun Watson money. We don't want to pay you Patrick Mahomes money, because right now you haven't shown us Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes play. And is there a scenario where they say, look, this is your value, and we're not going beyond this. And if we need to divorce because of that, that's how it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to an extent you could argue they're the first team that's kind of, which, you know, we think probably should happen at some point. The first team that realizes, like, these second tier quarterback contracts, when you're paying, you know, a Derek Carr, a Jimmy Garoppolo, a Kirk Cousins, whatever, when those guys come to the market and they're setting the market and getting the highest contract in the NFL just because they happen to be a top half of the league quarterback, you know, that's hitting free agency, and that's the only reason they get this deal, maybe they're pushing back on that and saying, look, we understand that's how it's been. We understand the next guy up, if he's good, generally gets that big deal. But we have a number set at, you know, let's say $35 million per year. And we're not going to go past that, because we think you're worth a lot and worth a good chunk, but we don't buy into this notion that the next quarterback up has to get the big deal. But that's kind of how the market's been. So they're kind of, you know, in a way they're working against the conventions of, you know, how that position market has been treated. And it's tough. I mean, quarterback, it's tough to nitpick with quarterbacks, right? I mean, they're the most important player in the building, arguably the most important person in the building. So, you know, I see both sides of the argument. I guess it could get to that point. I don't think it will. You know, because again, the franchise tag would be $37.7 million, which, you know, could take up like what, a fifth of the cap next year. So, and they already don't have the greatest cap situation. So that, you know, that's kind of a little bit of leverage for him as well. I think it'll get done, but I do agree. I think they have a number in mind that they would not like to cross. And that's where I think the years comes in. I think what they're probably saying is, we'll give you that number if you give us the fifth year. And Dak is saying, I want that number and I want 4 years. And that's where I think the disconnect is.
So Dak's kind of using the Cousins model of, right, shorter contract, let me hit free agency in 4 years. But also trying to say, let me get Watson money and Mahomes. Like, he's trying to get a lot of money for fewer years, right?
So he has all the leverage and has basically from the outset of this.
But it's a fascinating discussion, because we just saw his classmates from 2016, Carson Wentz and Jared Goff, sign big contracts, and their teams have serious buyer's remorse.
That's the silly thing about this, is that I think Dallas is right that they should value him at a certain point. They shouldn't want to go beyond that number. Their problem is that the only conclusion to that is having to walk away from Dak. And yeah, that's probably something that they don't want to do.
And the only thing is, I always use this point, right? 6, 7, 8 years ago in the NFL, that was scary, right? It was very scary to not have a starting caliber quarterback. Now you have teams saying, Jared Goff is a starting caliber quarterback, but I want better. So you have teams saying, I'm not ready to just settle for a starter. If I have to get Marcus Mariota or Jameis Winston, I can do that. They're available. where those guys weren't available 7 or 8 years ago, I don't think, in the NFL.
I think Dak's good enough, though, to make it scary again. Like, it's different walking away from an Andy Dalton or a Jared Goff. I think Dak is good enough where it puts it back into the scary category of, you know what, technically you're probably right, you should walk away, but there's a lot of capacity to get worse.
I will say, with Breeze going, Big Ben falling apart, with Rivers retiring, Dak is probably in that – he's in that top 10 guy.
Yeah.
Category, right? Top 8 type of quarterback category, right? So, got to pay him. This is the last question, Brad. You said Dallas wants to win every negotiation. How do you explain Zeke?
Yeah, well, I guess if you go to Cabo and threaten to hold out, I think maybe Jerry respects it. Maybe there was an aspect to it of, you know, this guy knows how to drive a hard bargain, and I respect his negotiation style.
I don't want to do it.
I don't know. It's interesting.
But I respect it.
We talk about positional value and all that, and Zeke's kind of – Zeke and Jalen Smith are the ones that were handed, you know, easy extensions, whereas they even let Amari Cooper, you know, reach the tampering window. And per some reports, the Washington football team, you know, offered him a bigger deal than the one he got from Dallas. And so he then, you know, took a slightly less deal, you know, to stay in Dallas. So it's kind of inexplicable. I obviously don't think they're totally aware of positional value, I suppose. The fact they took him fourth overall in the first place obviously hints that a bit. And that's something that I think we saw finally this past offseason where, I mean, Zeke's contract was really only surpassed by McCaffrey. Kamara's APY is $15 million a year, but that's because he has a non-guaranteed $22.4 million salary with a non-guaranteed $2 million roster bonus in his fifth in 2025, which there's a close to 0% chance he actually hits. So all these guys this year on the market all signed like 12 to 13 million per year deals, with not significant guarantees. You know, you look at Henry, Cook, all, you know, Mixon, all these guys. So I think the market has adjusted and has corrected. But unfortunately, they were a little late to the party there, and they followed Gurley with Zeke, and then it's kind of been downhill from there.
I love it. Great stuff, Brad. So Brad's, you know, again, new to PFF. You can find him. Are you at PFF underscore Brad on Twitter now?
Yep.
Okay, we allowed
I'm
him.
Official.
The official PFF name. So at PFF underscore Brad. Check out his work at PFF.com. We'll have him on again, hopefully during free agency, and talk more about this after the deals, and we can analyze it and everything. But great stuff, and nice to have a cap expert here at PFF. So thanks, yeah. Brad.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's it, Sam. That was good. Good discussion with Brad. Brings a lot of intelligence to PFF. It's great.
Well, that's new. Yeah, that's useful.
This is a new one. We've gotten so much smarter from the early days when it was just you and a couple other dudes, huh?
Yeah.
Started with me. Class of 2011, Sam.
Well, yeah. It was like the dip in the middle before we got smarter again.
That was Renner. Oh, Renner was the dip. Okay. Yeah. All right, guys. That'll do it. Everybody enjoy the Super Bowl. Have some fun. Hashtag let us know how you're watching the game and what you're going to eat and all that stuff. We'll check the hashtag, sure.
Okay.
We'll be back Monday. We'll recap the Super Bowl, and it's all off-season mode. Sam's been grinding draft film, and you know, we're gonna be getting into it. So appreciate everybody tuning in. Enjoy the game. See you Monday.